Merci Marianne, merci à tous de nous avoir accueillis, de m'avoir demandé d'accueillir Daniel Mouinoudins, qui est pour moi à la fois un très grand plaisir et un très grand honneur. And I'll carry on in English from now on.
That's good. It'll be easier for me.
It's a great honor and a great pleasure because I've known Daniel Mouinoudins for some time. In fact, for a long time, but he doesn't know it because I've known him through his writings. And the story goes like this. Some years ago, I was doing a similar conversation with my friend Vanessa, who's somewhere around here, with Anita Desai, the Indian writer. And we asked her a question, which I might ask Daniel later on, which was, what do you read or whom should we read? And she said, there's only one person you should read at the moment, and that's Daniel Mouinoudins. And that's then I sort of rushed to a bookshop and got this book, which is, in other words, Other Wonders, which is a collection of short stories, which was published in 2009, and which we'll be talking about a little. Daniel Mouinoudins was born in the United States and raised partly in America, partly in Pakistan, and he'll have occasion, I'm sure, to mention this. Was educated in the United States and studied standard subjects like English literature, but also slightly more surprising subjects like law at Yale School of Law for a number of years. So that he's also a lawyer, among other things. He has a great, as you will see if you have looked at the stories or as he will tell us, he's a great lover of the land of Pakistan, of sort of deep Punjab, where he has lived many years looking after a farm. And living on this farm, I think he gradually realized that while he was looking for possibilities of writing, while he was looking for form and subjects, it had been staring him in the face all the time, and that was what was around him. So this led, in turn, to publication of a number of stories, which were collected in the collection I just showed you, which won an incredible number of prizes, which I won't even start to mention. But just about every single possible literary prize that you could win, he has won or has been a finalist for. So, Daniel, it's very nice to welcome you. And
Thank you.
After this sort of brief sketch, you would like to say a few more words about your relationship,
yep,
perhaps, to Pakistan and,
yep, yep,
and to...
Well, I guess what I'm going to try to do tonight is, what I'll do and we will do together, is to talk about how I came to write these stories, because these stories describe a sort of odd moment in Pakistani history and describe a moment that I observed very closely, which was the sort of ending of the feudal order in Pakistan. So in order for me to explain that to you, let me sort of give you a little bit of my backstory. My father was from a family in Lahore, which was sort of the old cultural center of the Punjab. And they were land-owning people, but were basically city dwellers who owned land all over the place, in both close and far from Lahore. And in the 20s, he went off to Oxford and studied there, and then took he was much older than my mother. He was born in 1906. So he went to Oxford, took a degree, took the Indian Civil Service exam, and went off to Pakistan, which was in those days called India, to become basically one of the sort of, it was called the ICS, the Indian Civil Service, was called the steel frame that by which the English ran this huge empire. And he was one of this, there were 1,000 of them roughly, and these 1,000 guys ran this huge, you know, subcontinental empire. And he began this extremely enthusiastic, very excited about the fact that this is in the 20s and 30s, that they were now sort of, the English had built this beautiful machine And the Pakistani, the Indians had all been looking at it and salivating, the upper classes. And then the English decided that, or were compelled to give this thing away. So suddenly there's this beautiful sort of, think of it as a motorcycle. And these administrators were being handed the keys to this thing. So they were all very excited. And my father was one of these. And they were full of ideals and idealism and were going to take this over and run this country and make a great success, continuing on what I think indisputably is the success of the English in the subcontinent. And then partition came, and that was already a huge blow at partition when the India became divided between Pakistan and the Indians. That led, there were millions killed, and it was a terrible thing. Then the whole thing started falling apart, and it started falling apart very quickly. And I think you can argue at great length about why it is that it fell apart so completely, why the institutions that the English handed on were not maintained and developed and didn't form as a substructure upon which the locals could build a successful country. So through the 60s, the whole thing got worse and worse. And there were sort of various stages in the falling apart of this thing until in the 80s, I showed up. And that was when I entered the picture. I'm trying to do this quickly. And then we'll continue. And so when I showed up, my father had just died, or died soon after I showed up. And I started looking at this thing. And I'd gone to Pakistan. I'd been educated abroad. Gone to Pakistan specifically because I wanted to have stories to write about and wanted a place to where I might write about them, and moved to a farm in the sort of darkest, deepest countryside you could possibly imagine, and sat down and started writing very bad poetry and observing the world around me. And that those experiences are the ones that formed the basis of this book. And so basically what I observed was the feudal structure, which had been more or less sort of intertwined with the British power structures, this feudal structure falling apart or being transformed as it lost its British tinge and as it developed its own character, and as the administration and all the steel structure that the English had presented, improvised there, fell apart. And so that's what these stories are about.
But the stories are not so much about the English as about the locals, and no, about the local power structures and the local order and the sort of both the disintegration, but also the fact that it's remarkably resilient at the same time, isn't it?
Exactly. The stories in the book are structured around a family, which is more or less modeled on my own family. There's a sort of a central character, which is my father, though the character in the stories is much less sort of weird than my father was. He's the one in the stories is much more of a sort of classic feudal landlord. And then the stories describe all the people around him. So the sort of sitting at the center is this sun king who you know, believes that the world revolves around him, and his immediate world does. And then there are all these layers of people around him, you know, the ones who are closest to him. All power emanates from him within the world he's created or that's been bestowed upon him. And then there are characters moving out from that center, and all of them have sort of competing interests and competing desires and who are in conflict in various ways. And this was very much something that I observed in my family, that there was this sort of, it was very circular. It was something that should be very familiar to the French if they've studied their history, although on a much smaller scale.
And with the tendency of some of the characters to reproduce that kind of order, I'm thinking of, you know, for example, Nawabdin in the first story, that they live by the same rules and they reproduce at a lower level that kind of domination of the world. And there's a sort of, there's both a sort of external description of the workings of these power and perhaps also corrupt structures, and also a strong irony and kind of distance that you have towards that, which means that in turn the characters can become quite, you know.
What's wonderful, I mean, this for me, this was a very conscious project to, you know, I was graduated from college in America and was, you know, casting and wanting to be a writer and was trying to figure out how to do that. And it seemed very obvious that, you know, if you went to, in the, I mean, the equivalent of nowadays, you go to Brooklyn and settle down and drink artisanal coffees and write about living in Brooklyn, and that's not a great plan, because you're not the first person to think of it. Whereas going to live on a farm in South Punjab, it's almost inevitable that you're going to run into interesting just people and situations. So I very consciously went there and just started watching these things, and it, because I'd been in America since from the age of 13 to sort of 21, which were obviously critical years. And so this thing sort of hit me like a shovel on the head. I mean, I was trying to run this farm and the guys who I was supposed to be in charge of were obviously much, much, much more clever than I was or am. And there was a kind of corruption at the farm which was just mind-boggling. And which was, it took me about 3 years to realize exactly how corrupt these people were. That I mean, they would, if they could, they would sort of steal the shoes off my feet. And but they were very good at it because there was a sort of a system by which people, you know, like any super hierarchical system, you know, the people who had risen to the top on this farm were, they'd all started in the same place, which is very poor, and they'd fought their way up until they were very close to my father and were managing to sort of. It was sort of, you know, there's a, you probably remember from the Jungle Book, where the sort of snake has his, in the movie, his eyes start going like this, and he goes, go to sleep. And these guys used to do that with my father, and it was amazing to watch it. And they obviously did this to me, too. And then after a while, I started realizing that this is who they were. So there was this, and then trying to, you know, compete with them. So there, as a writer, there was this fascinating process of meeting these people and being, they couldn't get rid of me. They had to deal with me. And for good or bad, I was part of the, I was suddenly, you know, I'd come from nowhere and they hated it and they were trying to get rid of me. And I was doing business with them. And what made it tolerable was that I knew that I was collecting stories that would someday be in this book that I wrote. And that's what sort of, otherwise it would be a rather paltry effort.
So how do you do it, actually? Were you sort of running the farm during the day and writing at night, or?
I used to write in the morning, so I would get up very early, get up at sort of 5 in the morning and write for a while. In those days I was writing poetry, very bad poetry, but always sort of thinking about stories. And then at 8 o'clock I would start, you know, just sort of wake up and, you know, just, and it was marvelous. I mean, now I'm very nostalgic for it. At the time, it was very painful, just because I was completely isolated, and these guys were all around me, and were trying to, you know, they all had these incredibly well-thought-out agendas, whereas I was very innocent. I was sort of like, why can't we all do this together and make this work? And they were like, you don't understand, buddy. You're unnecessary here.
One of the things that that comes up in what you're saying these guys, and what's interesting in the stories at the same time is that a number of important women characters and women narrators, in fact, but the place of women seems, by and large, in the stories to be one that's sort of, I don't know how to put it, but there's some kind of nostalgia that surrounds their role. There's some kind of
A lot of people have observed that I seem to have this tic, which is that I seem to be very interested in powerless women who sort of gain power through men. Mm-hmm. And my
or analyst. Try to.
I've spent a lot of money on analysts trying to figure this out. but as a sort of description of what happens in Pakistan, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's fascinating that I've observed in so many, I mean, in so many different classes that there are very powerful women and that the strategies by which they gain their power are so interesting because they don't have the power themselves. They have to gain the power through manipulation of men because they're not given it automatically. I mean, the men, you know, there's some guy and he has the power, and then his wife, who's actually the person running the thing, she is, you know, playing with him, and he's a marionette. And it's just very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm quite independent of whatever my own psychological...
I wasn't trying to probe
into that. Exactly.
But at the same time, some of them fail, quite clearly, and provide with the death of the man she's invested in.
Yeah. Well, it's very complicated when you're trying to get power through somebody else, because, first of all, that other person may not be completely willing to give you the power, and second of all, you can't control completely whether or not that other person succeeds. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating problem that here you are, you've put all your eggs in one basket, you've got this guy, you've got him tidied up, you've brushed him and painted him and he looks great, and then suddenly he keels over and you're nobody. Mm-hmm. And so that's just a very interesting dynamic.
What is fascinating as well in the way this is happening in your stories is that what you're describing here as we talk and what transpires from the book as well are quite complex processes of power and et cetera. And yet they occur within just a few pages, you know, that sort of the story. So how do you work? Do you sort of compress material into a sort of short form? Do you have sort of 300 pages that suddenly become 20, or do you, on the contrary, work from a few sentences? How does the writing process?
I mean, I started writing in the 80s, and until 2000, and I wrote my first piece of fiction in 2001. So I'd been writing poems, and therefore, it wasn't that I was very accustomed to writing very compressed things. I mean, and so it came naturally. And the first time I started writing, you know, 5,000 word stories, I thought, my God, this is crazy. You can have so much space to play around, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, now I'm writing a novel now, and I can't. I mean, I'm about to go back to writing short stories, and I can't. I mean, I can't imagine doing that. My novel is 150,000 words, and I can't understand how it'll be possible to go back to 5,000. But my process was, and I found it was quite natural for me to write at that length. I didn't have to cut, and I didn't write more. Mm-hmm. What had happened is all those years I'd been writing poetry, I'd been sort of had all these stories that I'd been sort of thinking about and not writing. And so that when it began, it was very easy to start just going through them, and I still have many more, mm-hmm. Which I will do someday.
And are there particular sort of short story writers that you relate to or that you read or that you discovered afterwards that were actually quite important?
Of the Indian ones, I think the one is Manto. Mm-hmm. There's a guy named Saadat Hasan Manto, who is sort of a... He's just a natural writer. He's one of those guys who, you know, got up completely hungover. He was a terrible alcoholic, and sat down and whipped off something because he needed to pay for his scarf. I mean, he never had any money, but so people would give him sort of a little bit of money, and he would whip it off. And he has that rarest thing, which is that he can write a story which very evidently has been whipped off, and yet it's perfect. And his stories haven't been polished and buffed and done any of that with. They've been merely, as he just sat down and he had 3 hours and bring, he did it. The writer who I'm most, who I admire the most and who I read the most often is Chekhov. And he also has that quality, although he was much more disciplined than Manto. Manto only didn't write very much. And some of what he wrote is very flawed, whereas Chekhov, who had much more, was a much more grounded person, and living in a much more easy environment. I mean, Manto was living at the time of partition, so he was brought up, he was, you know, studying, and he was working in the film industry in Bombay, and then partition happens, and millions of people are being killed, and there's all this chaos, and India is being born, you know, as a free country, whereas Chekhov was living in a very subtle place, and therefore he had time to think about developing his art, and did, and wrote a great deal. But he also, especially in his early career, wrote these things very quickly, and they were brilliantly done.
There's something in Manto as well, which I find in your stories, is that ability over 10 pages to bring out a whole world. Like, you know, one thinks, of course, of Tabatek Singh, which is such the most perfect analysis of partition
right.
in 10 pages, which is about, it's about the lunacy of partition, basically. And you have the partition that affects that lunatic asylum, don't you? Do you read Manto in English or in Urdu?
Translated Manto from Urdu to English, mm-hmm. But I read him in English. Mm-hmm. My Urdu is very bad. It's appalling. My wife, who's Norwegian, and is like a blonde Norwegian, she reads Urdu better than I do, which gives you a sense of how bad my Urdu reading is, because I was educated entirely in English.
Mm-hmm. Which was
and by the way, the funny thing is that it's like the Russians in the old days, you know, in the 19th century, where none of them spoke Russian; they all spoke French. And now among Pakistanis, none of my friends speak Urdu or Punjabi. They all speak English. So, I mean, if you try to speak to them in Urdu or Punjabi, because I speak it perfectly because I have to, because I'm farming in the middle of nowhere, and these guys just don't speak it. They'll actually like switch to English, mm-hmm. Immediately switch to English if you start a conversation in Urdu.
Well, the interesting thing, of course, about Urdu is that it's nobody's language in Pakistan.
It's nobody's
just
language.
Just the official language. But.
But this also makes it easier if you're writing in English about Pakistan, because the audience, all 18 of them, mm-hmm. their first language is English. I mean, the language they use.
Is there a literature in Punjabi in Pakistan?
Very much so, which I don't know at all. But mm-hmm. there's a very rich tradition of poetry and of fiction even. And I was amazed recently to discover that they still have these poetry recitals, which are in the middle of nowhere, near my farm, which is literally in the middle of nowhere, where there'll be hundreds of people in the reciting these poems. And amusingly, the guy who is the Maulvi, the preacher on my mosque, we have a mosque on the farm, so there's a guy whose job it is to say the call to prayer. So this chap came to me and said, I've written a book of poetry, and I was so impressed. So I said, that's fantastic, I'll publish it for you. So we took it off, and it cost nothing. It was basically mimeographed, and they bound it and so on. And I was very proud of this thing. And I met this guy who was running these poetry events. So I said to him, here's the one that the guy from my mosque has written. And he looked at it and said, oh my God, this is so bad. But that was the end of my intervention in that world. I decided to leave this alone.
But which brings me to a more general question about Pakistani literature, both, of course, in the languages of Pakistan, but also in English. Because when one thinks about, especially you know in France or in the West, about literature from some continent in English, one thinks of the Indian writers. But there is a very long and very important tradition of Pakistani writers and contemporary writers.
Not long and not deep, but there have been some. Mm-hmm. There was Sarah Suleri, who basically wrote one book. She wrote a marvelous book called, and she was the first one. When I was a kid, when I first was writing, we were all amazed, you know, that somebody had written a good book in English. And Sarah Suleri was this, her family were sort of, you know, one of the families one knew. And she had this strange history in which basically her sister's husband had killed her. And it was one of those situations where everybody knew the husband and everybody knew the sister, and they all sort of went to dinner together, except suddenly, you know, he'd taken his wife to his farm and basically had her run over by a car. And Sarah wrote this wonderful book about it, it was a complex book, but that was the central grain of it. And then after that, it was sort of a quiet period. And then Mohsin Hamid, who was at he was at Harvard doing a law degree, and came up with a thing called moth smoke, which was, you know, everybody in Lahore, all the kids. I mean, I was a kid at that time. We also used to sit around and smoke dope and watch cricket. And it hadn't occurred to anybody that this would make a brilliant subject for a book. So Mohsin wrote this, and we were like, wow, that's crazy. I didn't know you could do that. So then that did very well. And then that, subsequent to that, there were two or three others. But that was about it.
Well, there's also Zulfikar Gosse and...
Who?
Zulfikar Gosse.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Bapsi Sidhwa. And
I mean, but I think, I mean, Bapsi is... Bapsi Sidhwa is a wonderful person, but her books aren't very good.
I don't know the person, I only know the books. And now there are a number of...
There's a number of others.
Of others, yeah. Who sort of seem to be...
And it's a small group, though. I mean, there are five or six people.
Right. And do you think they... Is there any kind of connection with, Indian literature, or literature from India?
I don't think so. I mean, these are all people who basically... they read Jane Austen. You know, they're all of these Pakistani. I mean, we all know each other because there's so few of us, and we're all people who are basically very grounded in the Western canon, and that's where we started. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions, but basically that's who we are. Mm-hmm. We're people who've read the Western stuff. Mm-hmm.
And is there poetry that's written in English, apart from yours, which is very bad?
Mine is hidden deep and dark. There has been some poetry written. There was one chap who actually had some success in the West, but not really. Not who succeeded. In translation, yes. Mm-hmm. There's Faz, and there have been a couple of others. Mm-hmm. But again, whose work I don't know very well. I'm like the others. I've studied the Western canon. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And since we're thinking about these writers, or contemporary writers, are there any sort of writers that you value or that we should read, perhaps?
The contemporary ones.
Yeah.
I don't really focus on. I mean,
you didn't read
my
them.
View is I do read some contemporary. Mm-hmm. The one who died recently was James Salter, who I was very fond of. But my view is, if you haven't read him, then he's contemporary. Mm-hmm. They're all new. If you haven't read him, they're all new. Mm-hmm. So I read sort of all over the place.
Right.
But it's an odd thing because I don't think the Pakistani writers would particularly say that they've been guided by the Indian writers. Mm-hmm. I certainly wasn't. Mm-hmm. When Rushdie's The Midnight's Children came out. We were again. It was surprising to see India and India presented in that way, or was effectively our world presented that way. But the effect was really more just of shock, of that initial shock. But in terms of how I developed as a writer, I don't think it was very important. I think my influences were all came from the West, or from Russia or wherever, South America.
Thinking about still about sort of ways of writing and different types of writing, it seems that a number of contemporary writers, perhaps not specific to India or Pakistan actually, but do write essays as well, or reviews, literary, or political essays or whatever. Is it something that you've done any apart from law journalism?
Not really, no.
Right.
Obviously it's very rich because. What's really interesting about both, my position and the position of all the other Pakistanis who are writing is that we're sitting in the middle, we're unusually situated that we're translating, this situation for these guys and that situation for these guys, this being the West in Pakistan. So obviously that's very rich for both fiction and for nonfiction. I mean, I've written nonfiction. Fair amount, but it's all been in sort of creative nonfiction. In fact, the piece that I'm going to read for us is that, and I'm about to write a memoir. That's my next project. Mm-hmm. Obviously that position of being, interpreting and being between two places is sort of what distinguishes us from the guy in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. That famous guy in Brooklyn with the beard and the craft beer.
And do you have a consciousness of whom you're writing for or not? Or not necessarily?
Well, I mean, you know, my family, mm-hmm. friends and family. Mm-hmm. I mean, who do I cares for it? Mm-hmm. Just a few people, you know, people I know. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, most in the West, I think. Mm-hmm. In the audience is very small in Pakistan, and in India it's bigger. Mm-hmm. But when I think about who I really care for, it would be about people in the West.
Right. And about a kind of special relationship to the country as well, and to...
I mean, I don't do it about... It's not really about an audience, right?
Right.
I mean, it's sort of an interesting problem, because if you don't care about an audience, then it's very solipsistic. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just sort of sitting there. But the most important part of it, for me at least, is that what happens in that room, where you're alone in the room for many hours and something very beautiful happens, which is that you manage to craft something that has meaning and that represents a thing you love lovingly. But at the same time, it's very complicated, because you want it to be beautiful not only to yourself but to others. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that if you ask me why I do it, it's because of I liked sitting in that room.
Mm-hmm. And when you sit in that room, do you have a routine, or do you
early sort of morning, mm-hmm. and always let it be fun. Mm-hmm. I don't care that much about success. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nice if it comes, but it's not that important. So I wouldn't do it if it weren't fun, and I keep it fun, mm-hmm. which means that if I don't feel like it, I don't do it. Mm-hmm. And if I feel like it, I do it for mm-hmm. as long as I feel like it.
Mm-hmm. And you write with a quill or with a pencil? Or with a...
I know. The best computer I can buy. Mm-hmm.
you mentioned a couple of times the novel that you're working on that you're finishing. Now, I had a look at Wikipedia, which claims that you're writing about a novel about Pakistan in the 70s.
No.
And now you told me that...
I need to go. See, there's a sort of...
In fact, I tried to, because I know you can do it, but I'm not enough of a geek to actually work it out, who wrote that page, whether
the funny thing is that apparently it's not considered okay to, like, edit your own Wikipedia page. Mm-hmm. So you're, like, the third person who's mentioned to me, so how about your story about India? But I feel sort of embarrassed. Like, I can't go in there and fix that, because it'll probably show that I've fixed it. That error has been persisting for a long time. But no, I'm writing actually a completely, sort of, as Monty Python says, now for something completely different. I've just written a novel which has nothing to do with Pakistan at all, and is about a girl in America. And I mentioned the word Pakistan once as a joke. But it's entirely about a beautiful, poor girl from Wisconsin who becomes a fancy lady in New York. And then, of course, Nemesis comes upon her. It's sort of a Bildungsroman. That's what I've done, just finished. And what I'm going to write next, which is, as you can imagine, my agent, when I told him I was going to write about America, he possibly died. He thought that was the worst idea ever. Because it's sort of be exotic. That's the byword. So my next book, he was very pleased to hear, is a memoir about growing up in Pakistan, mm-hmm. because I had quite a racy upbringing. My parents were leading complicated lives, so I'm gonna spill the beans. That will be the end of my relationship with my family, which one can see that many ways. Maybe I'm glad of that. That's my next plan.
So the novel, did it grow out of stories, or is it a completely different project?
No, I was actually writing a book about Pakistan, and then my mother died, and she died under very complicated circumstances. And I found that I just had to write about it. Mm-hmm. And sort of started with that. And then I hadn't written, you know, I'd only written short stories. It's been wonderful just because it's such a different, I mean, writing short stories and writing a novel are about as different as sort of painting and playing the violin, I think. Mm-hmm. Not quite, but getting there. And so it's just been this huge learning experience of where you're working at great length and have, you know, you can take digressions and work off the sides and come back in and introduce characters. And it's just, it's been very interesting. Would I do it again? Someday, mm-hmm. But it certainly is a painful process. It's been a long time. It's been 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So is it frustrating in the sense that it isn't?
A short story, you write it and then it's done in 2 months and you show it to people and they say, wow, that's amazing, or they don't. Mm-hmm. With a novel, you're sort of sitting there in your room for like 5 years and nobody says anything and it's sort of very quiet and everybody thinks you've died. And people are like, whatever happened to Daniel Munadin? He wrote a book a while ago. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you feel very sort of as if you've lost your audience, mm-hmm. the audience which you just briefly gained, and then mm-hmm. it's all gone away. What happened to the brass band, goddammit? Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping, so as I say, I'm going to go back to writing something. I'm going to write something shorter now. I'm going to write some short stories and then write a memoir, right. Which will be brief.
Perhaps there might be questions from the audience that
Should I read?
Do you want to read first?
Why don't I read something?
Yeah.
And then we can do some more questions.
So I'll give you some time to think of your questions.
Is there not time?
Yes, there's plenty of time.
Are we okay?
Yeah.
So I'm going to read, actually. I've published two pieces of nonfiction which are sort of going to end up in my memoir in The New Yorker. And this is from one of them. So basically, I've been sort of working through. Ultimately, I'm hoping to publish a bunch of these in The New Yorker if they'll have them, and then collect those, make those into a book, sort of the way Nabokov did with Speak Memory. And so there'll be sort of these discrete little pieces. And this is from one of those. Pakistan had all through my schooling exerted a fascination upon me that arose not only from intense nostalgia, but also from my divided identity, my sense of being perhaps more like my American mother than my Pakistani father, even as a child aware that I observed the place from a remove through a sensibility that stood at a slight angle to it. My family had been Lahoris for generations, city dwellers who owned farmland rather than country people translated to the city. And yet the nub of the identity that I sought to examine and capture, the source of the longing that drew me home, lay not in Lahore, but at my father's lands. Children are the most romantic of creatures with respect to landscape, if not to people. Certain images that I captured in the Punjabi countryside as a boy are central to my imagination, are the ones that I draw back to when trying to imagine exactly who I am, what wood I am carved from. Very simple images, the curve of a dirt road running through tall grass, galloping a pony around the curve, just old enough to keep my seat, the animal fetlock deep in the dust, running away with me and leaving behind a long swirling plume, or dawn in the desert, just as I have shot a deer, chasing it down from an open jeep on the desert flats, the shikari, the guide, wiping blood from his knife on the animal's stiff furred flank, the driver pouring steaming tea from a thermos, and the sun rising over the dunes, my hands quivering still from the chase, myself on the verge of tears. I suppose I will never again experience freedom as I felt it then on the farm at 5 and 8 and 12, the gold and green of it, and the dust in my sandals, and the cow-heavy smell of the village, piles of white warm cotton high as houses to be climbed, and the smell of oil pooled where the tractors were kept, and where I wickedly hunted sparrows with an air gun that made a most unsatisfying sound when fired, as if it were spitting. At 8, I received my first real gun, a .22 rifle, good enough for sitting doves, though I rarely hit one, and a year later, a handy little ladies' shotgun, which finally put me on the way to hunting game, deer in the nearby desert, duck on the ponds left over from the great flood of 1973, snipe in marshes that became as familiar to me as my backyard in Lahore, so that I drew them according to plan, cunningly, planning how to move the birds about the marsh to get multiple shots before they winged away into the distance. My shikari, my hunting guide, who died between two visits, my first significant death, had six toes on each foot and carried an ancient muzzle loader with which he would shoot sitting coot and long-legged wading birds, black-winged stilts, birds that no other person would eat, boiling them for hours in a stew pot that he never cleaned or emptied, but simply topped up with whatever he happened to bag. In the early morning, as we kneeled waist-deep in reeds, waiting for the flighting duck, patches of fog burning off as the sun rose, the water icy, he would groan and mutter, saying, "Oh God." Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.